All right, guys, welcome once again to your Adonis Lifestyle Podcast. I'm Brad Howard, and I've got John Barbert on the phone. And today, we're going to officially kick off. I know we said we're going to do it back in January. We're going to really officially kick off the muscle growth of 2011. Remember, 2011 is going to be mainly about growth. 2010 was mainly about fat loss. So we did a lot of fat loss stuff in 2010. This year, we want to do a lot more on muscle growth. And today, John wants to talk about how to actually think about muscle growth, some of the things to kind of keep in mind, how to measure it, and some things like that. So with that being said, let's get to it.
Sure. So the first thing, I think the first thing that we need to cover is the fundamental flaw in the way we even speak about muscle, and that's gaining and losing muscle. That right off the bat, I think that sets everyone up for that sets you with the wrong tone of how to think. Muscles don't, you don't build it and lose it so much as you, you guys have to get used to the concept of inflating muscle and deflating muscle. Now there's two parts to it. There's the fluid content of the muscle, so the water content, which is, you know, over 80% of the muscle is just water. And then there's the, what I like to call the scaffolding of the muscle, which is the actual protein. The protein, I guess, walls. I don't know the fibers themselves. I don't know how else to describe it. It's kind of an abstract concept. You can't view them as Lego blocks. You can't view them as bricks on a house. You can't view it that way. But the closest way to view it as, and you have to keep reminding yourself, they're just like water balloons. And you always have to picture, when you say build, you don't think of building a water balloon. You think of inflating it. So that's where the word build is already the wrong word. And then it frames your mind incorrectly, and then you kind of can start thinking in the wrong terms of what you need to do or what's going on when you lose muscle and, quote, bulk up. And then you can also start falling for marketing that maybe isn't forthcoming or is trying to pitch you on another way to gain, quote, gain muscle or build muscle that's just not really the correct way of viewing it. So to get the thought process more on line with what you're actually doing, it's probably more correct to right off the bat change the words. And because we think in words, the way you think, until there's a word for a concept, you can't actually conceive of the concept because we can only think in words. So we need the correct word, and the correct word is, and the correct way of thinking of it is a water balloon, and it's not necessarily building it as much as inflating it. Now, there's two things. There's this, like I said, there's the contents, and then there's the actual balloon itself. So adding protein, so to speak, to your muscle and fiber would be the similar to building a bigger balloon, like the actual rubber part of the balloon. And then the transient states of how full the balloon is more like how much water is in the balloon. So if you imagine someone who has been weight training for 15 years and has built up, I always use the example of my buddy who ripped his bicep tendon and who's built up a muscle to however big he could over the course of 15 years. And then he tears his bicep tendon and it immediately shrinks to – it's smaller than it was when he was 12 years old. Like it just shrinks right up. Now, it only took him 6 months to build it back up to its full size again, and not its like normal pre-workout size, but to the size it was after 15 years of weight training. And so that tells you that the rubber of the balloon is all there. It was just deflated when the tendon was cut. And all he did was just reinflate it back up to its full size. So there is quite a bit of – and this is where the concept of muscle memory comes in and all those things. Now, I don't like that. That's too the concept of memory is too sort of
– hocus pocus.
Yeah, it's too whimsical. It's too here or there. I like to say that the scaffolding of the rubber of the balloon is built. And even after cutting, the tendon was completely severed, and he was in a cast, and the thing shrunk like crazy. But it came right back to full size. It came all the way back. And he had big arms. He had 17-inch arms, and it came right all the way back to 17 inches in like 6 months. So that tells you the scaffolding was all still there. It's just that it was drastically deflated. And when he got back into training and the tendon healed, he could inflate it back up to 17 inches. So it didn't take him 15 more years to build that muscle all of those 15 years were spent remodeling the rubber of the balloon, so to speak, so that once reinflated, it would become 17 inches again. So, and enough. Now, if he had stopped training, now again, there may be some time frame to the remodeling of these muscles. Let's say he stopped working out for 10 years. Now maybe it would take years, not 6 months, but maybe it would take years for him to get back up to his full size. But there's definitely some delay there, and there's some amount of time you can spend not working out, and then the muscles will bounce back. So right off the bat, before we even start talking about muscle growth, we need to, and I said that specifically, we need to get the idea of build out of there and get the idea of growth back in there, because it's not, we don't, building isn't necessarily what's going on. It's kind of, it's more a concept of a growth state and an ability for the muscle to hold, I guess, more fluid. And that gets into the transient states of muscle. So when we are trying to lose fat mass to get lean, the process of being in a caloric deficit. You all right there?
Yeah.
The okay. process.
Trying to keep it low.
The process of being in a caloric deficit may also spill over into not necessarily always having the muscles fully hydrated or fully, quote, inflated during the period of time when you're trying to cut down. Now, that doesn't mean you've lost muscle. So in this case, you wouldn't necessarily have lost any of the scaffolding around the balloon, so to speak, or the rubber of the balloon, as much as you're just not always filling it with water and glycogen. So that's the best way I can describe it when you're cutting down. So it's not like the muscle's gone, because just think about this. On a 12-week cut down, that's 3 weeks, 3 months, you're not losing actual muscle tissue. For example, I'll go back to the example of my friend who tore his bicep tendon. He was out of commission for longer than a 3 month cut down, and that muscle came all the way back to full size. And he wasn't moving it; the tendon was severed. So anybody who thinks they lost muscle from a cut down, you haven't. Your muscle's just not as fully inflated as it normally is. And again, that's just due to not being in at caloric maintenance or in a caloric excess, which obviously in an excess, every amount of all of the glycogen and sugar and whatever else your muscle was and protein your muscle is going to store, will store all of it before it goes into fat. So I guess eating it to maintenance or in a slight excess, in one way you could say, well, if I'm gaining fat mass, at least I know for sure I've filled my muscles as big as they can be filled. So that's one way, I suppose if you were going, the whole concept of bulking, if you were at all ever going to argue why it would be of any necessity at all, you could say that, well, since I can't measure inside my muscles, and since I don't have any kind of way of knowing how much I need to eat to like fully rehydrate and fully compensate my muscles after a workout to the point where I know that this much food in the day did it, and then the next meal is overdoing it, and straddling that line of not gaining fat, without really knowing exactly where that spot is, you could argue that, well, by slightly overdoing it, at least you guaranteed you got to that spot. Because by gaining a bit of fat, you're like, well, that tells me that the excess calories went into fat, so that means my muscles were full. Because you have to understand, when you eat, the order of where things go, where nutrients go, is your liver first, muscle second, fat third. And then any other cell that's going to be metabolizing nutrients like as they go in without even being stored. But as storage vessels, it's going to go liver, muscle, fat. So I guess you could argue, at least I'm not trying to say you should bulk, but if anyone who's even going to use the bulk argument, the only way it makes sense is that, well, by gaining a slight amount of fat, that's my signal that I know that I've filled my muscles up for sure. Because right. The excess has gone past muscle into fat. But again, you don't want to really be putting on a lot of fat mass. So that's sort of the idea of maintenance, is to refill the necessary tissue. So refill the liver, any of the other tissues that are rapidly using up energy, and refill your muscles and then stop right then. So that's the concept of maintenance, because anything past that's just going into fat mass. The trick is, how do you really know when you're exactly bang on it? So it's kind of, and that's when you get into eating to calorie expenditure. So not just BMR, but BMR plus whatever exercising you did. So it's a fine line, and I don't think it's if you're somewhere around maintenance, there's no reason why that shouldn't be enough. And again, any fully in a total excess, that doesn't mean it's going to stimulate muscle growth any better than just maintenance. So it's a slow muscle growth is a slow process, and eating at maintenance always should stimulate muscle growth just fine, because an excess doesn't, I mean, eating to the point where you're gaining fat mass, that's not going to have anything to do with muscle growth.
Right. Yeah, so the first thing I can think of right now, just kind of going back, is going back to the first thing when you were talking about, you know, adding scaffolding and all this stuff and the muscle memory is, I already know that guys want to know how steroids play into that, and why, you know, a guy can lose his arm and he comes right back up because the scaffolding's there, but, you know, and with a lot of the steroids, you take the steroids, but when you come off, you know, over time, you know, that drops back down. So
I think there's different mechanisms going on there. So the effect that weight training by itself, first of all, steroids is a blanket statement. There's multiple different drugs that actually bind and do different things. Certain drugs, I mean, straight testosterone just binds in the cell and it does exactly what testosterone was going to do. Other analogs of testosterone bind in a slightly different way and affect different enzymes at different rates. So that's why each steroid actually does have somewhat of a different effect. They can even produce a different look, because some of them affect fat mass differently. Some of them affect glycogen storage differently. So there are multiple effects you get. Or different effects, distinctly different effects from different steroids, and that's why they produce different looks. So that's why some of them are considered bulkers, and some of them are considered useful for burning fat as well as building muscle. And some of them are based with testosterone. Some of them are based with dihydrotestosterone. Some of them are the base compounds. They're just different. And then the way they enter the cell and the way they interact with the nucleus is different. So there's – and they've all been – I mean, they all have different degrees of research on what they do, and they're never being really developed for mass dosing for muscle building. They're developed for wasting patients in various diseases. So the reason why – some of the reason why they have come up with different compounds is to accommodate the other issues a patient wasting from cancer has versus a patient wasting from AIDS versus a burn victim, and then the testosterone's for guys who just naturally have low hypogonadal, they just have low testosterone. So with each case, the reason the drug is developed a certain way is to overcome or sidestep a different issue that given patient population has. So for example, an injectable versus an oral, and then something that's more or less toxic to the liver or to a given situation that a particular patient group may have that excludes them from using one drug versus another. So if or because that patient group is on a different drug, like by definition, if a patient, you know, if an AIDS patient normally has prescribed drugs X, Y, or Z, and that's just something they're going to have to be on, then that may exclude certain steroids from being used by them because it compounds their liver toxicity or compounds their side effects. So they end up being prescribed a different steroid, because otherwise people are like, well, why isn't there just one testosterone that everyone takes? But the reason is all the different patient groups that may be using it may be on other drugs. They may have other side effects. They may have other deficiencies or other risks where it merits the research and development of new and different types of drugs to accommodate each patient group. And now because of that, you end up with drugs that have all varying side effects, but all varying effects in general. And that leads into the when bodybuilders are kind of doing their own experiment, finding out that, oh, hey, this drug really, really bulks you up, but it makes you kind of bloated and watery, but super strong. But then this drug over here, you don't really get bloated, but you actually kind of lose body fat. And then this one over here works really well, but it makes my joints hurt. But this one over here makes my joints feel better. And it's just all over the place. And that's
right.
And so when someone, well, why, how can they all be that different? Well, that was the explanation why. They're not built for bodybuilders. They're built for all of these different patient groups. But when, who all seem to have something that's compromised, well, seem to, they all have something that is compromised, which is the disease, along with the all of the other sort of problems that come with it, along with the side effects of the standard drugs that they would have been taking. So you, when you piece the puzzle together that way, and then you take a bunch of otherwise healthy guys who are just grabbing a bunch of drugs and taking them, then it manifests as all different effects. And then, right. And then the sort of underground steroid culture comes up with their own data set, so to speak, observations, and I wouldn't say research, but their set of observations on what each drug does. And they've been used enough by enough guys with enough consensus on what each one does that most of those type of steroid handbook type things and just the forums, and it's relatively accurate when you have thousands of people using the same drugs and they all report similar findings. I know it's not a scientific experiment, but in general, you know, if it looks like a duck and it walks like a duck, it's a duck, right? And then once you have – it becomes pretty obvious which drugs do what, and it's not hard to find that information. And so that's a relatively large tangent to come back to the point that the way muscle is built without a drug isn't necessarily the same as the way muscle is built with a drug. And then beyond that, it even depends on which drug you're even talking about. So it's not on drugs and not on drugs. You can't really make that distinction. It's even beyond that. It's like you got a clean guy who doesn't even use creatine or any test boosters or anything from the supplement shop. That's one group. Then you've got guys who will mess around with supplements. Like, yeah, I'll take a creatine and test booster. I'll try some things out. Then you've got guys who have bigger budgets who can afford to mega dose supplements. Or like when me and Pilon worked at some of the supplement companies where we had unlimited access to free supplements, I used to always joke that there's three kinds of guys. There's guys who use supplements. There's guys who work at supplement shops who can use an inordinate amount of supplements, and then there's guys who can use drugs. And then those are kind of your three levels, because most people just can't afford to take the amount of supplements that we would mess around with when we had free access. So we could try literally, I mean, what you would call experimental doses that the average person – I mean, we were using enough stuff sometimes that it was like $500-$600 a month worth of retail supplements. Like no one would do that, right? Like no one right. would – no one would actually spend that much just to see if it would work. But when we had unlimited access, we were sure, we'll try it out. And we were just cross-referencing with some of the research. Like I don't know if people are aware that some supplements are researched and proven to work, but only at a dose that's economically impossible for anyone to afford. So there is some data on glutamine that suggests it might really help, but at a really, really high dose, like a dose that would be $40 or $50 a day for people at the going rate of glutamine on the market. So in that case,
like a whole tub.
Well, like 40 or 50 grams of glutamine, like a lot, right? And,
yeah.
And so, you know, it's being sold in 3 or 4 gram doses, and glutamine's not cheap. Like it's even though it's still relatively, like when you put it in those terms, it's completely unviable. Like you'd be using $20 or $30 worth of it a day. But when you're in a position to actually be able to use that much and not spend any money on it, well, now you can experiment, right? Now you can see what that much glutamine can do.
Right.
But the average person will never know because they're like, oh, I'm not spending $500 a month on glutamine. I don't care how potent it is.
All right, so let's kind of reiterate that whole point that you talked about right there, that, you know, because now I guess we're kind of myth-busting and throwing some things out there about that. So the fact of the matter is that, you know, there's a lot there is research on a lot of the supplements out there, but the research requires such a high dose that the dosing has to be so high that for the normal, you know, average guy, he's not going to come anywhere close to it.
Well, he's never going to be able to afford it, is the point. Like there are various products where the promising research or the research that was approaching statistical significance, let's say it that way, was in a dose. See, scientists don't care what the dose is and if it's at they don't care if it's at an affordable dose. All they care is like what's the dose that does something and is it safe? And so let's say you and I have 20 guys in a study. And we're dosing them with – I'll stay on the glutamine. And 5 grams a day doesn't really do anything. 10 grams doesn't do anything. And then we have a group at 30 grams a day. And we're like, oh, man, those guys seem to be – they're recovering faster. They seem to be improving beyond the other groups. And even though like our p-value is at 0.05, it's not quite statistically significant, but it's like trending that direction such that, man, if we only had them in the study for another 2 months, I think we would have got there. Like everything was pointing that direction. And then you look back and how much glutamine costs on the market, and you're like, oh, right. But then that means the average guy would need 35 grams of glutamine a day for the next 120 days at a cost of $15 or $20 a day. Okay, it's important. No one's going to do that.
Right.
So it's kind of like if you come up with the cure for cancer, but it costs $1,000 a day, most people can't afford that, even if that is the cure. It's like South Park did a joke, a parody on that, about AIDS, when the kids get AIDS and then they're trying to figure out how to cure it, and then they go visit Magic Johnson, and he found what the solution was. All you do is liquefy $300,000 and inject it into yourself,
right?
And so they go to Africa and tell everyone, like they go to some African country that's like got a high AIDS rate, and the kids just go out shouting, "We've got the cure! All you have to do is inject yourself with $300,000." So the joke was there is a cure, but just the average person can't afford it. Which is basically the story about certain supplements may actually work at a higher dose than you can ever afford. Some of the test boosters. I know guys who are bridging between steroid cycles with Status, the test booster that we developed, that I developed with the Blue Star guys. But the guys that are bridging with it use more than the labeled dose. But they find it works really well.
Right.
So there's another thing going on there. There's the legal dose you're supposed to say it's the minimum dose that the research suggests will do something. And that's how supplements are formulated. That's how we put Status together. But then there's the dose guys experiment with. And so I've actually talked to a few guys and I'm like, well, it says 4 caps a day, but I experimented with 6 and I know a couple of guys who use 12. But they're coming off of a cycle, and they were like, well, that worked for me. That's what they were saying. So I'm like, oh, okay, well, 12 sounds like a lot. But the point is someone has – just because it's hard to say whether or not – the statement of like, does this product work? It's like the next question is at what dose?
Well, yeah, everything we talk about is dose dependent.
Yeah, the entire story of all of this is dose dependent, even if you're just taking supplements. Like I was – we were in Amsterdam on our way to India, and we stopped off at a gym, and we were just talking to a trainer who had a couple of bodybuilders he was training. And we were following up on a couple of leads to see if we might sign a couple guys as sponsored athletes. And so we were just chatting, and this guy was doing all kinds of experimentation with supplements, and he was mega dosing creatine, and some of his clients, he was getting them to take between 50 and 70 grams a day of creatine.
Oh, holy cow.
Yeah, I know. And I was like, really? And he's like, yeah, why not? And I'm like, yeah, I guess so. And all the research is very benign. Like there's no side effects to creatine. It's one of the most benign, safest supplements, and it, repeatedly in research, no side effects ever come up. So, I'm sure he didn't care. He was just seeing if something would happen. And, the research that I've seen on it is always speaking towards the lower end of what's the minimum amount you can take to get a result without having to go above that. I don't think I've ever seen research trying it at that high of a dose. They may have done dose response studies to test for side effects or enzyme kinetics and things like that. But in general, I don't know that anyone's chronically dosed it that high just to see what would happen. So, I mean, who knows? Maybe nothing was worth – maybe it was anything past 5 grams. It was just all of a waste. But – they didn't care. They were just trying it out. So, and who knows? Maybe that was high enough a dose that something starts to happen again past a certain threshold. But either way, it's the point. The point is, a lot of people don't think, or they just look at the label and they're like, "Well, that's just what it says." And And I don't blame people. It does seem a little bit odd, or I don't know if the word's scary, but it's a little touch and go to be just mega dosing things that look like drugs. You know, supplements look like a drug. I mean, they're not as potent as any real drug, but drug meaning anything, over the counter stuff like Tylenol, Advil. I mean, when you see a capsule or a pill or something like that, most people are acclimatized to the concept that taking a lot of them is probably not a good idea, simply because of the vessel. Now, if it's in a liquid form, like let's say you have a fortified orange juice or something that's got, I don't know, some vitamins added to it or some kind of ingredient, that already becomes easier to overdose because you don't view it as a drug. You view it as just a glass of orange juice. Incidentally, that's one of the big controversies about fortifying food at all, and especially drinks and stuff like that, because a kid, like let's say you have a 10-year-old in the house and they just come in from playing outside and they drink some orange juice. And now if that's fortified with some kind of active ingredient that has drug-like properties and especially a dose response curve, well, what's to stop that kid from drinking the whole carton if they're just thirsty? Which if the fortified ingredient is potent as a drug, that's no different than him taking a handful of capsules.
Right.
But it's hidden because it's in a juice instead of in a capsule. So fortifying functional foods with things that have some kind of dose response. So right now, mostly it's just vitamins. But even vitamins you can overdose on depending what kind of vitamin it is. So, and that's one of the major points of contention, and that where companies are very leery about fortifying food items, because it's very easy to overeat and then ending up overdosing a functional food because you're not viewing it as a drug with a dose response. Whereas if you have a handful of capsules at a very young age, you're like, oh, that's probably not a good idea to just down this whole handful.
Yeah. Probably not a good idea to choke these bad boys down.
Yeah, well, yeah. And so the vessel becomes an issue when it comes to, like, fortifying food. And no one really thinks of it that way until you kind of present, well, what's the overdose issue? It's very simple. Like, what if you're just thirsty? And you're just like, oh, yeah, that's the fortified juice. I shouldn't drink that.
Yeah, and then with some of the other stuff that's kind of scary, too, in regards to that, is a lot of the stuff, so let's say, like, Yohimbe, right? I think I was reading where the danger value of what you take and the effective value are so close, like the window.
I don't think so. Not for Yohimbe.
You don't think?
No. That's actually one of the best research supplements out there. Well, okay, but Yohimbe is. No, it's been researched at quite a few doses. It's just everyone's sensitive. Everyone's got their own sensitivity level to that. But I get what you're saying. You can cross the line pretty quickly. Now, certain things are dosed at much lower levels than others. Right. Some things you only need in microgram quantities, other things in milligrams, and other things in grams. So you've got all kinds of levels of quantities there. So if you something like Yohimbe, you only need a couple of milligrams for it to do something, whereas other items you need it in gram. Like creatine, you would take it in gram quantities, right? Like 5 grams is the standard dose. Yohimbe, it's way down. It's like a few milligrams.
Yeah, and then when you start getting some other stuff, you're talking about micrograms.
Yep, like B12 and stuff like that. Some of your vitamins are in microgram quantities. So you've got things at all different levels, and they all can be mixed in the same supplement. Yeah. And that's another reason why certain ingredients They all have their own cost associated with them too. I guess we're talking about supplements.
Well, I mean, we're talking muscle growth.
Muscle growth for the year. So each one of these will kind of go its own direction. So when we're building a muscle, when we're putting together a muscle building supplement or a supplement that's the intention is to help with muscle growth, we're just finding the ingredients that have the best research or the best indication that they can somehow help with that. In a cost-effective way within a given product. So if money was not an issue, I would build a supplement significantly differently than the way we build them, considering money is an issue. There's nothing else to be said about it. That's just how economics matters. And actually, it's an interesting thing. I was just meeting with Adam, the guy who my friend who owned Blue Stars, his company, and we were just talking about potentially he might start putting together a few new supplement lines that are only for distribution via the online channel, such that we can do what I just said and is actually start developing products that would be economically unviable in brick and mortar stores because of the cost of getting them to the store, because there's that extra step, right? There's the step the retail and the wholesalers have to take their cut, whereas building it, warehousing it, then shipping it direct to customers, we can build an even better supplement with more stuff in it, more expensive ingredients mixed into the same supplement instead of at a cost that people can actually afford. So we were just kind of brainstorming if that's viable. But the thing is, it could only ever exist as a digital product. Otherwise, it would become too expensive. So in other words, there's probably three or four ingredients I personally would probably put into a muscle builder altogether that would be too expensive to ever do in a product that would have to go out into your local supplement store. It would end up being a $150 a month product. It just, by the way the economics works, you could just never pull it off for any cheaper than that, which the average person probably wouldn't bite on that. They'd be like, that's just too much money.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, with your Keystone pricing and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, well, the wholesaler gets their cut, and by the time the retailer gets their cut, the thing is just too expensive on the shelf. Yeah. But if we put that same item together and sold it direct to customers online, there's no wholesaler, no retailer. It's literally we build it, warehouse it, and send it. Well, we, Adam. And that way, that product would come down significantly in cost to the point where the ingredients would be better than everything else in the store, and the price would still be good. The only thing is you could never go buy it in a local store. You'd have to buy it online, which actually we were thinking about. It might actually be a revolution in the supplement industry when you look at it that way. Because right now you may not be aware that the reason the formulas are so similar on products that you can go buy in your store is because they're stuck by the economics of it all. The amount that it costs to put the product together, and then the amount that the wholesaler takes, then the amount that the retailer takes, and then the market value of all of it on the shelf versus your competitor who can buy in bulk versus, you know, the bigger companies can get all the ingredients cheaper. There's a price that's set on the shelf, and you basically have to comply to that price. And if your product is 50 to 100% more expensive, no one's going to buy your product, even if it's really good. It's just no one's going to spend that much money. So there's a price that's set, and that price is the determining factor on how you formulate. So you're literally limited by cost on the formulation. So the products you have available in your local store aren't necessarily as good as they get. It could be better. It's just going to cost more. Or it could be better, but the only way to buy it is direct.
Yeah, just because of the economics. I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense to me. I mean, I guess it's the same way where, you know, like we go buy drugs at the you know, CVS or whatever, and if it's not covered by your insurance, how it's just ridiculous, you know, and runs through there. I'm sure it's the same way. But then you go look online at some of these places that sell stuff like Vet Places or whatever, and since they're selling direct to consumer, I mean, the prices are a lot less. Of course, I mean, now you got to wonder if you're actually getting the real stuff. But most of these places like that sell vet stuff, like instead of getting it from the vet, if you buy it from, you know, one of the websites online, then you know it comes down a little bit. So yeah, I mean that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so it's there's different levels there. So I guess to kind of bring the story around to starting off our muscle building theme here, there's, and this also bleeds back into why you can't compare yourself to other people. There's different people using different things at different doses, with different training experiences, and different dedication to their training, who apply a different intensity level in the gym. All of these things are factors into how much you can coax your muscles into growing. And so that's why everyone's not really comparable to everyone else, because you need a detailed history and a detailed account of what everyone's doing. It's another reason why communicating in the forums and just buzzing around and asking exactly what people are doing is important, because everyone's really has detailed explanations of what exactly it is that they're doing. I mean, right down to sets and reps. And I mean, if you could, a huge revelation for people would be if you get to train with each other. Like if you and I and two or three people, we all got together and trained, we'd immediately recognize who pushes harder than the other guy. And then you'd be like, oh geez, I don't push that hard. Like I've, for the past 6 months, I've been going what I thought was hard, and then after training with such and such person, I realized what real intensity was, or something like that. And I mean, so there's so many words that we speak that we don't really know. Like when we say like maximum intensity, maybe we don't really know what that means. Like when one person says it versus another. Like I think I push pretty hard, but I've trained with guys who push harder than me to a point where I think it's a little obsessive. But then I've seen people who give up too soon, and I'm like, well, yeah, you know, to me that's about half intensity. So I mean, that's just something you have to learn over time. There's no, you know, I can write out 12 reps, but I can't really know if you're doing all 12 the way I would expect you to do them. It's just, I can never know unless I'm with you. Like I need to see like what it looks like. I need to see how hard you're put. Like I'd have to kind of be there to feel it, to see it. So I mean, some of these things, it's just learned over time, and that's just the actual actions in the gym. Like how, I mean, I think one of the biggest mistakes, or not mistakes, but the biggest, the biggest misunderstanding is how hard pushing really is in the gym. Like how hard you can really push. I think a lot of people just have never pushed hard enough yet, and they just don't know. And that's one thing that they're missing out on. I mean, they're following everything along as it's written, and stuff just still isn't working, and it's because they're just simply not pushing hard enough. I mean, that's one of the things that just needs to be in place before anything else even matters. So I mean, there's multiple factors to consider, and then beyond that, it's, you know, any nutritional intervention, if there is one at all, you know, supplements or caloric deficit maintenance or excess. All of those things are overlaid on top of your training, on top of your consistency, you know, on top of all that stuff. So your results versus someone else's is so multifactorial. It's just, it's really not that – I mean, you really need to get to know that person to know if you should be comparable to them, at least as far as progress goes. And then beyond that, there's just genetics. Some people respond better than others. And there's that is pretty well documented in the research, that the given the same training protocol – with the same trainers, the same everything, different groups of people will respond completely differently.
Right.
They'll have a different rate of strength gain. They'll have a different rate of muscle growth. It's just different. And I mean, just as we all land somewhere slightly differently in the somatotypes. I mean, I don't know that there's too many true endo, ectos, or mesos at all, but just the concept that we all are built slightly differently. It's not a surprise that we all react to the same training protocol slightly differently too. And that's, I mean, and everyone should recognize that they have the rep ranges that they like better. Like Pilon likes the low ones, like the fives, the 3 to 5s. And I have a buddy who just doesn't like going anything below 12. And then everyone else is somewhere in between. And that's, you know, that's just how everyone's built. And so it's, you're going to have your unique set of genetic makeup, lifestyle factor, all of that stuff. It's very unique. And, that's incorrect. It will be unique to you. And then from there, you just got to work with what you can and can't, add into or subtract from your life to start stimulating growth. And me and Pilon are actually working on a new concept, a new piece of research and a new way of categorizing everything that supports all of our training theories. And, we'll be talking about that in a couple weeks, but there's something else to consider. When it comes to all of this, and we'll be elucidating that over the next weeks and months. That kind of, it's just a new piece to factor into the way you think about all of this as well.
Cool. That sounds good, man. Like I say, I don't think we've got anything else. I know I want to talk about probably next time or down the road the actual body types and really kind of get into that. I've seen some stuff a couple months ago about how that those things came to be and how they're not really exact. And you've talked about it before, but I think maybe really going into the detail and talking about that, because I think a lot of people actually use those as crutches.
It's like, the somatotype. Yeah. I'm an ecto. I can't gain all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so, kind of clear a lot of that stuff out of the way, so that we can really, you know, do what we do, clear out all the BS and, you know, all right, well, here's what it really is.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's a good direction to go with it. And, I mean, questions that flow in on this will help direct us to what the next sort of – where the next pressing issues are. But in general, this is where we're going to start from.
Yep, cool, man. All right, you got anything else?
No, I think that's pretty good.
All right, cool. Well, for John Barber, I'm Brad Howard, and that's your Adonis Lifestyle Podcast.